before the next lecture starts. Teresa, should we take a break or should we just be a little early? Be a little early. Okay. It's my pleasure to introduce our next lecturer, Dr. Majerzik. Dr. Majerzik is the director of the Stroke Center and the Telestroke Services at the University of Utah. After serving as an officer in the U.S. Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, she earned her medical degree at the University of Vermont. She completed her neurology residency at the University of Utah and a stroke fellowship at the University of Michigan. At the University of Michigan, she earned her Master's of Science degree in Research Design and Statistical Analysis. She came back to the University of Utah in 2008, taking over the Stroke Center leadership in 2010. She is very active in community leadership, including national service to the American Heart Association, Telestroke, and the Emergency Neurovascular Care Committees. In late 2013, she received an NIH grant to be the principal investigator of UT StrokeNet, a regional coordinating center in the new NIH Stroke Trials Network. This should provide access to stroke research across our region. Thank you. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Majerzik.
All right, you guys can hear me, right? I'm going to test for a minute. Whoa. So should I do this one off? Or this one? I'm not much of a wanderer. All right. So nice to see everybody. Is there an echo to you guys? Because it seems like it to me. Yeah? I think I should turn this off.
All right, now you can't hear me at all, right? How about now? All right, let's just do this one.
We'll call it good. So it's really nice to be here today. It's great to see lots of people who are interested in learning about all kinds of things, but particularly about stroke. As they were saying, I am a stroke neurologist, so my training is in neurology, and stroke has been my passion for many years now. I was asked to talk about acute ischemic stroke care. If there are other things you guys want to hear about, we can hopefully have time at the end for questions about that. But this is really a talk mostly focused on the emergency room treatment. I'm not sure how many of you guys work in the emergency room or in the hospital, but hopefully this will be of some interest to you. I don't have any conflicts of interest. I do have NIH funding for the Utah StrokeNet, and I will be discussing off-label use of TPA, but I'll tell you when I'm doing that. So, and the slide's a little bit cut off. So I actually decided to put right up front the top 10 things that I want you to know from this talk in case you fall asleep halfway through. And actually, there's not really 10 things, whatever the six ones are. And this is something that goes to every single physician, no matter what they do, that you really should teach your patients who are at risk for stroke what the signs and symptoms of stroke are. A shocking number of patients, including those who've suffered a stroke, don't actually know what a stroke looks like, and so they don't know to call 911. The second thing is that you have to tell them that if they do call 911, there's actual treatment that works, because many, many patients are fatalistic and just think there's nothing to do, and so they stay at home. So you have to teach them there is a treatment and that you have to call 911 to get the treatment, and that will hopefully actually improve our treatments across this country. The second is to have a plan in place at your hospital, which all the hospitals in this region do, but it's really important that you have a pre-notification system and roles and responsibilities for who's going to respond when the stroke patient comes in. And then the second to last, TPA, which is the focus of a lot of this talk, is an effective treatment, and it's really expected in this day and age if it's in the right patient. Obviously, it's not expected to be given in a patient who is not eligible. In this year, intra-arterial therapy, which we'll talk a lot about as well, is a bit of a moving target. There's no easy answer for whether we should do that or not. The bottom line, though, is that time really matters. So getting the stroke patient to the ER fast for treatment, whether it's hemorrhagic or ischemic, is critical. So today we're going to talk a little bit about epidemiology of stroke, stroke systems of care, both nationally and in Utah, and then the current science of advanced stroke care, which really focusing on recanalization and the results of the newest trials. That'll take up the bulk of my talk. So why care? Stroke affects about 795,000 people yearly in the United States. It's the leading cause of disability, cognitive impairment, and death in the U.S. when you lump all those together. It's actually the fourth cause of adult death overall, and that's an improvement. It used to be the third cause of death nationally. In Utah, however, we're still at the third cause of death. We haven't bumped our mortality in this state yet. What state you're in, what gender you have, what race you are, and what age you are, though, differentially affects the impact of stroke. So I kind of like this slide because it shows death attributable to all cardiovascular disease, not just stroke, from 1900, and it shows what a remarkable rise we had in the first half of the century. But we're actually having an impact. You can see the curve, we've bent the curve, we're coming back down on the other side. And that is true for all cardiovascular disease, total, I didn't mean to do that, stroke and, let me go back one more, total stroke, coronary artery disease. All of them have had a decline in the last decade. Sorry. I think it's going ahead on me. All right, we're okay. So I just mentioned this, that a lot of people think stroke's not a problem in this state, that we don't have difficulties because we have a heart-healthy state. But actually, we're not as good in stroke as we are in heart. These are cardiovascular death rates by state for all cardiovascular death. So red is the lowest and blue is the highest. And so you can see nationally, we have some of the lowest rates of cardiovascular mortality. But when you look at coronary artery disease, which is on the top, and stroke, which is on the bottom, we actually bump up in stroke. So our coronary disease is not bad. We're the lowest in the country, but our stroke disease is higher. We don't know the reason for this. So if you're going to ask me, you can just save that question because I don't know. I don't know why. We're trying, but we're not there. This shows that stroke affects different races differentially. So while white ischemic stroke has dropped, so the green bar is 2005, the blue is 1993, and the red is in the middle. And you can tell that our incidence has been dropping for ischemic stroke in whites, but you look at ischemic stroke in blacks, and we've stayed fairly steady. Similarly, an intracerebral hemorrhage, we've made really no difference. Our incidence is still increasing for both races. For subarachnoid hemorrhage, whites have held fairly steady over the last two decades, but African Americans have had an increase in their incidence. So again, it's not all of us are the same. We're having differential effects by race. And then not surprisingly, by age. I'm giving a talk on Saturday for anybody who's coming to the Stroke Symposium. We'll plug the Stroke Symposium. But I'm talking about stroke in the young, which is not the focus of this talk. But stroke is rising in the young. Obviously, it's mostly a problem of the elderly, with those over 85 being differentially affected more so than those younger. But nonetheless, there's a true incidence across all decades of life. It's a very expensive disease. It's not as expensive as heart disease, but it does actually cost almost 2% of our national health expenditures, which kind of surprised me, considering how much cancer and other things cost us. And that cost is, of course, going up. I like this slide because it actually shows the differential cost by type. And for all of us physicians, you'll notice our line is fairly flat. It's not us that's causing this exponential cost rise. So when people say that, you can tell, no, it's actually the hospital costs. Medications are rising as well. So I'm going to transition now into stroke systems of care. 20 years ago, nobody really cared about stroke systems of care. It wasn't even on the agenda because there was really no treatment for stroke. So there were no standardized stroke care protocols. There were only a couple of stroke units even around in the world, no less in the United States. But in 1995, the landscape really changed, and that's when the first TPA results were published that were finally positive through the NINDS. And the FDA moved very quickly to approve that in 1996. For the next couple of years, there was absolute chaos. And I don't know how many neurologists are in the audience, but particularly people who had been neurologists a long time ago who weren't all that interested in running to the ER to give TPA, it caused a lot of practice pattern disruption. So suddenly there's a treatment that people were expected to give, but emergency physicians and internists weren't that comfortable, and neurologists had never really been raised that way. And so nobody was actually doing it, and there was, I think chaos is probably the best phrase for it. Over the next couple of years, individual metropolitan areas began really coordinating stroke care and having a better approach to it. And Phoenix and Houston really stand out as centers that did that very well. In Utah locally, 2004, we established the first stroke center at the U of U. The following year, the Stroke Systems of Care article was published and again commented on the fragmented care. In Utah specifically, we've done okay. So in 2003, we had our first stroke task force formed, and it's been running ever since. We have quarterly meetings. Everybody's welcome to come if you want to come. I'm the past chair. Now Kevin Call at Utah Valley runs it. University Hospital was certified as a primary stroke center in 2004. and began a telestroke network very quickly thereafter to try to help rural hospitals give IV TPA, essentially. By 2009, there were 5 primary stroke centers in Utah, and the following year, EMS routing protocols began. I'm going to spend a few slides talking about that. Last year, the University of Utah we were honored to be the first comprehensive stroke center in Utah, although there's a couple of other centers in the state who also provide very good services. I like this slide because it shows the U.S. dissemination of EMS preferential routing systems over the years. So in 2000, you see Houston and I think Alabama there lit up, and then slowly over the years, more and more red states. And you see by 2010, finally Utah is lit up there in red as well. And these are the states that have said EMS should direct stroke patients to a place that actually gives appropriate stroke care. And we don't have a national policy. This is state by state by state. So I'll show you, I'll get to that in a few minutes. Why do we care? So rates of appropriate TPA use in this country, actually worldwide, are abysmal. We have about, on a good day, 3% of ischemic stroke patients receiving TPA. And 64% of hospitals in a study done in 2009 had never given TPA in the previous 3 years. You'll be happy to see that Utah does not show up on the map as a state that's never given TPA. And in fact, you can see 3 red dots there that are really reflective of this region, Salt Lake and then up through Ogden, as hospitals that are participating in appropriate ischemic stroke care. But there are large swaths of the country where hospitals really aren't giving this treatment. If a hospital uses a data system such as Get With The Guidelines through American Heart Association, and an ischemic stroke patient presents quickly, so within 2 hours, the TPA rates are actually enormous, like 62% in 2003, 70% in 2009. And what it shows you is that those hospitals that are engaged do actually do the right thing and give treatment probably when they should be. And that this is sort of my usual example, but there's a lot of other examples of how systems of care work. So if you're reliant upon one doc, one nurse, it's never going to work. But if you have a real system of care, we can come together. So I've kind of been dancing around this, but TPA has to be given within 3 hours in most patients, or 4.5 in some, and I'll go over that data in detail. Jeff Saver at UCLA did an amazing paper a couple years back actually calculating how many neurons are lost every minute that a stroke is untreated, and it came out to 1.9 million neurons, which is, of course, horrifying. It's also surprising that we have that many neurons at some level, but anyway. So that gets you to the golden hour concept, which has long been around for STEMI, for cardiac disease, for trauma, but it's really, we're trying to push that now in stroke, and that you really need to be treating within 1 hour of the patient's arrival to the emergency department. And I'll tell you, that's not easy. This is data showing why we care about the 1 hour rule. So this on the y-axis is the odds ratio for a favorable outcome, and on the x is the minutes from stroke onset to treatment. And the likelihood of you doing good with your treatment just goes down the longer you wait. So when we dither around in the ER, you know, trying to do this or that or the other, we really are losing brain cells minute by minute. So in Utah, I'll back up a little bit. In many states, particularly like say the Bay Area or LA, they have a bypass system where EMS is directed to bypass hospitals that are not stroke ready and to go to the one that is stroke ready. In this state, we have such big distances to cover that the Utah Department of Health and those of us on the stroke task force felt that probably wasn't the best policy, that really we should have a policy where all hospitals become stroke ready, because otherwise a patient in Tooele is never going to get the treatment that they need because it'll take them too long to get to another facility. So multiple thought leaders or state leaders, stakeholders came together, the Bureau of EMS and Preparedness, the Stroke Task Force, and the Utah Hospital Association. And by 2008 and 2009, we all developed this transport system. It's a hub and spoke system where hubs are primary and comprehensive stroke centers, and we act as referrals and consultative centers to what we call SRFs, or stroke receiving facilities. Those centers are certified by national bodies, so either DNV or Joint Commission. Stroke receiving facilities, on the other hand, are certified by the Department of Health, specifically the Bureau of EMS. And I've participated in some of those certifications, and it's actually really fun going to the hospitals and seeing what policies they have in place and how they're ready to take care of a patient. They are able to utilize primary stroke centers for consultation via phone or telestroke. They can transport patients if they need to, which typically they do. What's required to be a stroke receiving facility is the list here. So you have to have a 24/7 stroke physician and nurse, but the physician doesn't have to be a neurologist. It can be whoever has, typically it's an emergency physician who's there on site. They need to have stroke protocols in place, including a consultation plan. They have to have 24/7 CT labs resulted within 45 minutes. And they have to collect a really minimal set of outcomes measures and commit to ongoing stroke-specific education. So I can never project this appropriately, so I'm sorry. This is the current state map, and it's missing, I think, just one hospital who recently came online, showing which types of hospitals are what. So the yellow is primary stroke centers. The S are stroke receiving facilities. The red C's are critical access hospitals that are not either. And then some you can see are both. They're red with a little green circle around them. Those are critical access hospitals that are also stroke receiving facilities. And then the H's are none of the above. Now, I will tell you, some of these sites are actually telestroke sites, but I think, yeah, that's our map. So some of our own, so at the university, we have 14 telestroke sites, and these are our locations. Some of them have not become stroke receiving facilities, and we're trying to work with them to become one, because they clearly have the capabilities, but they haven't, frankly, filled out the paperwork yet. So we're actually pretty proud of this other map here. Bob Jex, I don't know if any of you know him, but he's the nurse in charge of the Bureau of EMS. And he estimates that probably 80 to 90% of our patients are within, you know, 60 minutes of one of these hospitals that are showing up as stroke ready. And that's great. That's a really big change in the state from where we started 15 years ago. And the other thing, I love to show this slide. This is our door to needle times as a country. And I probably should have blown up Utah for you, but I'll read it to you. So these are the percent of patients who get IV-tPA. So of those who get IV-tPA, how many of them are getting them within 60 minutes? You remember 60 minutes is our target, it's our golden hour. And so those in gray have 0 to 24%. That's not the box you want to be. And those in red are at 50 to 74%. You can tell nobody's in bright red. Like, we really would like to get those numbers even higher. Utah, we are at 58.2%, so we're right up there with the best of them in terms of mid-50s into mid-60s. And I really think that has a lot to do with the Bureau of EMS and how hard they've pushed to help get all of our hospitals ready to take care of stroke, as well as some of the big stroke centers and all the primary stroke centers really working on this together. Okay, so let's talk about treatment. We'll switch gears. So I have a small vignette. So there's a 50-year-old female at work. She had sudden onset of left hemiplegia. Her coworkers call 911. They notice right away. They bring her to a stroke center 40 minutes after onset. She has left-sided weakness, face, arm, and leg, sensory loss, dysarthria. And then, so we calculate an NIH stroke scale of 12. An NIH stroke scale is a very standardized measure of stroke severity. It goes from 0 to 42. You rarely see somebody above 25. So 18 and above is a very severe stroke. 8 to 18 is a moderate stroke. Under 8 would be considered a mild stroke, which is not to say that under 8 can't cause disability. You can have, like, hemi field cut and not be able to drive anymore and only have an NIH stroke scale of 2. So it's a little misleading. But anyways, we use it as a marker of severity. So what would we do? So this is the original tPA trial that I was discussing before, published in 1995. It was a randomized, multi-center, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. 8 U.S. centers, but over 40 hospitals, and it was both academic and community centers. And it tested tPA 0.9 mg per kg IV versus placebo. You had to have an ischemic stroke within 3 hours of onset, a measurable deficit on an NIH stroke scale, and then not be on any anticoagulants. This is the long list of exclusion criteria that came along with this trial, and this is what we've been living with ever since. And I'll go over this more in a bit. But you can tell we excluded a whole lot of people. And this list is one of the reasons today that so few people get tPA. However, the biggest reason is that people don't get to the hospital in time, which is why I was saying the very first thing I want you all to do is go back and teach your patients signs and symptoms of stroke so they'll come to the hospital. So all of these things in that trial excluded patients from receiving IV-tPA. The big ones, obviously, are any history of hemorrhage or any current hemorrhage, time windows not being appropriate, elevated blood pressure, platelets that are low, glucose that's not normal, and then anticoagulant use. So this trial showed that at 24 hours, patients had an improvement in their outcomes, but it was not significant. It was like 0.06 instead of 0.05. One thing that's interesting and that the stroke neurologists always like to talk about is that if the NINDS had chosen any other cutoff of what they considered significant, it would have been significant at 24 hours, but it doesn't matter because it wasn't. So one thing I do tell patients is we don't usually expect a Lazarus effect with tPA. It's not like everybody gets better within minutes after giving the drug. The real difference is typically seen at 3 months. This is the 3-month outcome, and it shows multiple different measures. So they used what's called a Barthel Index, a modified Rankin Scale, Glasgow Oakham Scale, NIH Stroke Scale. All of these are different measures that are popular in stroke neurology, and every single one of them showed that there was a statistical improvement at 3 months based if you got the TPA. So this is how we often show this data, and you're going to see this on a few more slides, so it's probably worth going over. We call these Grotta bars after Jim Grotta, who's a UT Houston stroke neurologist who's quite famous in my world, and I guess he must have pioneered them. It's nice to have like a graph named after you instead of a disabling fatal disease, I guess, which is usually the way in neurology. So the top line is, so these are modified Rankin scores. Let's focus on that one, the middle one that says modified Rankin scale. 0 to 1 is basically minor symptoms that don't affect you or no symptoms. 2 and 3 is symptoms that are starting to bother you, like you may not be able to return to all of your daily activities, but you're still functional. 4 to 5 is not a good place to be. 4 to 5 is where you need you need care now. You're not just independent living any longer. And then 6 is death. So the modified Rankin scale is a really squished scale. 0 normal, 6 dead, you got 1 to 5 in between. So it's kind of, it's a little misleading. But the point is that what you really want to see is that your drug shifts people to having more people in 0 to 1 and 2 to 3 and fewer people down in the 4 to 5 and 6, okay? And so what you can see is the shifting across all of these scales that does exactly that, showing that that TPA pushes more people into the 0 to 1 category and the 2 to 3 category and fewer in the 4 to 5 and death. So we usually quote this if patients push us. Percentages are very hard when you're having a stroke, but there's about a 30% relative risk reduction of bad outcome or improved outcome if you get TPA. This is the thing that everybody's afraid of, and this is another reason that TPA is not used a lot, is because of intracerebral hemorrhage. I wish I had a different slide on this because I could make you guys guess which of these were TPA-related hemorrhages and which ones weren't. Basically, people can't guess. Some of the biggest hemorrhages were actually in the placebo group. So the truth is, hemorrhage is part of ischemic stroke, no matter what we do. There is no question that giving TPA increases the rate of symptomatic hemorrhage. In the original NNDS trial, it was up at 6% versus about 0.6% in the placebo group, and that was significant. But in the end, it does not affect death or mortality. So there's no raise. I've actually had patients say, oh, doc, give me the TPA because I'd rather die anyway. I'm like, well, okay, first of all, that's a terrible attitude. Second of all, it doesn't actually increase mortality. So yes, it increases intracerebral hemorrhage, but not in a way that increases death. I have another slide that I'll show you in a minute. Jeff Saver, again, the guy who did the study about how many neurons die per minute, also did this a couple of years back, showing the number of patients needed to treat to have benefit. And again, it depends on how you define benefit, but basically it's about 3 to 4 patients that you need to treat with TPA before someone will have benefit. And in order to harm them, it's 30 to 55 or 60 patients. So from our perspective as stroke neurologists, this is a very beneficial thing. This is a slide I was looking for. So this is was derived at UCLA also, and it's a graphic that a lot of us use to show benefit of TPA when you're in the ER trying to treat somebody, because all these numbers are really confusing. When somebody asks me, what's the benefit, doc? It's hard for me to put that into words, so I show them this picture. So this is representing 100 patients with this acute ischemic stroke, and those in green are those that would have benefit from TPA. Those with, if you really want to get into the details, the ones in black who have the little black dashes are the ones that are going to have some worsening, but in the end, half of those will get better, and so it's really the red ones in the end that are truly worse from the TPA. And I think it's a nice thing to say, look, your odds of getting worse are there, but they're a lot less than the odds of getting a lot better. And the dark green, if you want to get into nitty-gritty, are actually normal patients or almost normals. So those would be the 0 to 1 modified Rankin, and the light green is a lot better. There's a whole lot of people, though, you can tell who didn't get better at all. I mean, it's not like TPA is the end-all, be-all. We have a long ways to go still. All right, this is a true story from my partner, Janet Wald. Oh, no, this one's not hers. There's another one that's worse than this one. All right, 75-year-old male at home. He's watching the news in the evening. He develops dysarthria and right-sided weakness. Oh, it's not supposed to be at a restaurant. The news show is at 5 p.m., and he's home alone, so it takes him a while to get to the emergency room. He doesn't get there till 8 at night. His head CT is negative, he has no history of stroke, his NIH stroke scale is 5. And so we probably put his onset at 3 hours prior, around 5 o'clock, that's the best we know. And so we're out of the IV TPA window. Or are we? And that's the question. So ECAS 3 studied TPA versus placebo at 3 to 4.5 hours, and this was done in 2008. It was another double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and inclusions were very similar to the original TPA trial, except for a couple of things. No one over 80 was allowed in, and you couldn't have an NIH stroke scale greater than 25. You couldn't have combined diabetes and prior clinical stroke, and you could not be on anticoagulants, which actually was in the original trial, regardless of your INR. And so with those additional caveats, these are the results. So they enrolled 800 patients, and their primary endpoint was modified Rankin again at 90 days. And they found that over 52% of patients had an MRS of 0 to 1 in the TPA group versus 45% in the control group. And you can see again on those grata bars the shifting of the numbers. So alteplase is the other name for TPA. So the top lines are the ones that show the TPA group. More of them were in the 0 to 1 group, and fewer of them are in the bad groups of 4 to 5. There were, again, more hemorrhages with TPA, but again, the mortality was the same. So an odds ratio for favorable outcome in this window is 1.3, which is not very high, and number needed to treat is 14. So you remember before, if you're treating in the 0 to 3 hours, we have a number needed to treat of only 3 or 3.5. And out in the 3 to 4.5 hours, we're at a number needed to treat of 14. So our benefit is not nearly as high in this window. And this graphically shows that. This is actually a pooled analysis of the major TPA trials. So I only went over NINDS and ECAS, but there was others as well. And the longer you wait to treat, the less likely you are to have benefit, to the point that really it is at about 270 minutes that people say the lines are crossing and there's no point to doing it anymore. Hemorrhage, again, pooling it. Hemorrhage is seen in about 5 to 6%, depending on the trial, of the TPA groups, but it does not have nearly as clear of a correlation with time of onset. So you can see hemorrhage at any time when you're giving TPA, not just in the late hours. This just shows the TPA that's been given over the years through this one registry, which is in Europe, and showing, so in blue is the 0 to 3 hour window, and red is the 3 to 4.5 hour window. And you can tell in Europe they were actually kind of doing it for a while, a little bit on the fringes, but once that paper was published, the 3 to 4.5 hour window did take off. And I think in general, our rates have been rising. But these are actually numbers on the side here. I had a slide that I couldn't find that showed the percentages, and we're still well under 10%, you know, like 3-4% of all patients overall. So inclusion-exclusion for the 3 and 4.5 hour window is what I said before. You need to be under 80, no concurrent diabetes and clinical stroke, and really we pretty much stick to the no anticoagulant use. We don't, even if the INR is normal but they're on anticoagulants, most of us won't do it. We try not to have stroke be major, NIH strokes go greater than 25, and then obviously the TPA has to start within 4.5 hours. So the AHA Science Advisory Committee, the year after that was approved, came out with a statement saying that TPA should be administered to eligible patients who can be treated in the time period of 3 to 4.5 hours. Unfortunately, I can't remember if it was the following year or the year after, the FDA, Genentech did apply to the FDA for approval in that window, and it was declined. And we were never given reasons for why it was declined in that window. It is approved in Europe. It's used in that window in Europe. And so in our own practice at the U, we just take a cautious approach. And so we do it, but we talk to the patients and explain it's not FDA approved, and also that the benefit is not as great as it would be in the earlier windows. So if somebody is particularly mild, I might be less inclined, but if they're more severe but not so severe, I mean, this is a very subjective thing. We really just try to talk to the patients. I think one thing it does help, though, is the patient who arrives at 2 hours and 45 minutes, we never could have treated them within 15 minutes before, but we could treat them within 30. And so I feel a little more comfortable now that if I'm at 3 hours and 15 minutes that I'm not breaking some sacred law. But one of the things it also brings up is that you shouldn't just stand around waiting and thinking, oh, well, I can give it 4 hours and there's no problem. So we still try to get our door-to-needle times to be quite low if we can. I think, well, I guess the only other thing I wanted to say was that there is some thought that the FDA declined to approve it mainly because the benefit is there, but it's not that strong. But they didn't ever tell us, so I can't tell you if you have questions about that. And I've asked some people, but they're not talking. So what I call the frontiers of TPA use, like where we're going with this, there's a lot of desire to use TPA in what we call wake-up strokes. So somebody goes to bed at midnight, wakes up at 6 a.m., and and is whatever, hemiplegic and aphasic. When did that stroke actually happen? Probably didn't happen at midnight, but it probably didn't happen at 6 a.m. either. We don't know what time. So there is a study going on called the wake-up study, appropriately named, to see if it's safe to use tPA in these patients. I have done it maybe twice, maybe three times, but only with really specialized imaging. It's not something that I feel entirely comfortable with. There are centers that do it routinely, particularly in the Bay Area. So this is something that you'll probably see literature coming out about as the community comes to kind of comes together with a consensus on this. Minor stroke is another really big thing. So if somebody has a stroke that causes a little bit of hand weakness or a little bit of facial numbness or facial weakness, are those patients we should be treating with tPA or not? There's very clear consensus that if your stroke is going to cause you disability, so like I said before, if you have a field cut and you can't see, particularly out your left side, it's very hard to return to driving. That's a pretty bad disabling stroke. Your NIH stroke skill could be only 2, but most of us would treat that with tPA. Similarly, if you lose your right hand, your dominant hand, most of us would have trouble returning to work, and that actually results in a very low NIH stroke scale, so most of us would treat that as well. So the PRISM study is really looking at even more minor strokes than that, and those are the ones that a lot of us have walked away from. I didn't prepare slides for you on minor stroke, but there's been some pretty good data showing that those patients, something like a third of them, still end up having to go to rehab, some of them die, and some of them go to nursing homes. And for me, as a neurologist, when I decline to treat somebody, and then the next day I go see them and realize that their stroke has gotten worse, it's about the most heartbreaking thing I can do, because I had the opportunity to treat and I didn't do it. And so this is a big issue in our community as we're trying to sort this out. There's no question that some strokes start out small and then what we call complete, they get big, and that's what we'd like to avoid. I was just talking to Dr. Varma in the hallway about the newer anticoagulants and what to do with them. None of us know. If someone comes in on Pradaxa and has a stroke, I know what to do if they're on Coumadin. I have very specific guidelines, but I don't know what to do on Pradaxa or the others as well. Most of us just don't do it. We don't give tPA in those situations because we can't imagine that it's safe. Some of us have done it accidentally because the patients tell you they're not on anything and it turns out they are. And I will tell you that every one of them has bled very badly. And so it is something I would not do. I would never recommend doing it. If you call me at night, I will tell you don't do it. But we don't know how long since your last dose, is it safe? That's where it gets into the nitty gritty, like if you took it 2 days ago or 1 day ago. I don't know where that cutoff point is. There's studies now to look at adjuvants to lower ICH risk. We'll be doing one ourselves in a couple of months. That's part of a national trial. And those are things that you could take along with the tPA to hopefully reduce your hemorrhage risk. There's studies in cooling right now, particularly in those that do end up recanalized. There were lots of work on using advanced imaging, and I have some slides on that coming up for thrombectomy, but really to improve patient selection even for IV tPA. That's how I've done wake-up strokes, is if I've had advanced imaging showing me that there's no core infarct yet, then I felt more comfortable giving it. The big thing is reducing door-to-needle times. So when I was at the stroke conference and at the neurology conference recently, there were just like 2 rows of posters every day talking about door-to-needle times and how each system was reducing them. There was a group in Chicago who had like, they'd actually given tPA within 7 minutes of arrival to their hospital. It was shocking. So some people are really making a lot of headway in this. And then relative versus absolute contraindications for tPA, and that's the next slide, I think. So I have highlighted in orange what we consider now to be true absolute contraindications to IV tPA. And all of the white ones we consider to be relative. And so this field is really moving. There are papers, multiple papers on every single one of these bullet points that goes into it. And I don't even have pregnancy up there, but pregnancy is considered a relative contraindication as well. So if someone has intracerebral hemorrhage, obviously you're not going to give a lytic. Like, I think that's about the most obvious one that you can say. And if they've had intracerebral hemorrhage in the past, most of us wouldn't do it. The symptoms of subarachnoid hemorrhage, if you think they're having a subarachnoid hemorrhage, don't give them tPA. That just seems, you know, again, pretty obvious. INRs that are elevated is a very dangerous situation. I wouldn't do that. And it's, again, if you're on heparin. But all of the rest, you know, the surgeries, typically what I do is call the surgeon and say, your patient's just suffered this. I know they had surgery yesterday. How comfortable are you with me giving IV tPA? And I will say probably 9 out of 10 times they say, go for it. I'll just fix whatever you cause in their hip or their gut or whatever. On occasion, they'll say, no. You know, I just did, particularly the cardiothoracic surgeons will say, no, I'm not comfortable with that. And then we'll go on and do thrombectomy instead of IV tPA. But I just have that one-on-one conversation, and that works out actually pretty well. And then number one was the rapidly improving minor symptoms. We talked about that already. Blood pressure. We do require people to get blood pressure down, but it is really rare for us not to be able to do that anymore. So most of us will use a nicardipine drip, and the blood pressure comes down pretty quickly, and then we're safe. And so we haven't used that as a... in the original trial, it said don't treat if you're on continuous infusion for blood pressure, but now we so routinely use nicardipine that we don't use that as much anymore. All right, so the bottom line for IV-tPA, there's really not a lot of arguments remaining. There used to be in the past. There was a lot of discussion about this. There's not a lot of arguments remaining anymore against its appropriate use. I mean, clearly don't use it in the wrong patient. Have careful attention to onset time. A specialist can kind of help you sort out the patients that are not clear, you know, where you're just not sure, like they've had surgery or, you know, God help you, they're pregnant or whatever. But the longer we wait to give it, the less benefit there is. We really push to give it early. I got to go to the Spiral Jetty on Sunday, and that's why I like this picture. But I was kind of trying to use it to show that I think we're honing in on the center of with tPA. I think it's been a long couple of decades trying to figure out who we can use it in, who is safe, how to make this all work. But I feel like slowly over time, it's getting better. My husband says that's a stretch, though, for an analogy. So I don't know. All right, so this is my sad case from Jana Wold, my partner. All right, this is a 55-year-old male who had AFib, was off Coumadin due to recent ablation. He went with his wife to the movies at 4:45. This is the bizarre part. They decided to sit separately because the theater was empty. So I think they have some issues as a couple. The movie ended at 7, and his wife went to go find the husband and found that he couldn't talk and he couldn't move his right side. So he arrived at the in the ER at 7:30, had an AH stroke scale of 15, which again is a pretty big stroke. So he is 2 hours and 45 minutes out at this point with a large stroke. They got initial head CT, which is on the left. And even though this isn't perfect, I think you can see that there's vessels on the right side of the brain that you don't see on the left. And then in this image here, is this the pointer? Yeah. This is a big cutoff, so there should be a vessel going up and doing its thing here, and instead there's just nothing. I'm going to show you the end of the story, and then we'll talk about the data in between. The end of the story is that he did get revascularized, and actually you can tell this was the original film, and now this is new film looking much more healthy, and like there's actual arteries there that could be feeding his brain. So intra-arterial devices and trials, I use the acronym IA a lot, it means intra-arterial, so slides are hard to fit everything on there, so hopefully you'll follow along. The Mercy device was the first one that came out, and it looks like a little corkscrew. It like screws into the clot, and then in theory, they pull it out, and the clot comes with them. In practice, it's actually really hard to use. I don't do this, but my colleagues do. But some clots have a lot of calcium in them. They're really hard to screw into. Some of them are actually soft, and they screw in, and they can't pull it out. So both of those can be difficult. Penumbra came out next, and it's actually a sucking thing. Like you put the catheter in there and then pull with the suction device on this clot. Patients hate it. They cry. They don't like it. It hurts because you're actually pulling on the meninges, as you can imagine. So I trained during the era of those two devices and ended up with a stroke neurologist being in the cath lab with the interventional radiologist for hours and hours. A couple of years ago, Trevo and Solitaire came out. I don't actually know which one this is a picture of because I'm not a catheter person. Our neurosurgery friend's checking it out. He's like, so those are amazing. These are called stent retrievers, and they expand in the artery, and then you leave it there for a few minutes, and the clot sticks to it, and then you pull the whole thing out. So it's a removable stent. It's not a stent that you leave there forever. You put it in, you allow the clot to attach to it, and you come out. We used to joke that, like, in the old catheter cases for these things, I would have time to go buy dinner, come back, check my email. They're still in there. I'm talking to the family. Now if you go get coffee, you might miss the entire case. So they're much, much faster, which is great. So I want you to understand that difference in speed because it's going to affect how we interpret the trials that have been going on with these devices. All right, so I am not going to make you read the slide. This is a slide my fellow prepared for a talk that I made him give the residents, and I borrowed it from him. There have been a whole lot of IR trials, and one thing that I want you to notice, if you can, is that mortality, so IR trials are generally in big stroke. They're not in small lacunar strokes. They're in the large intracarotid or internal carotid occlusions, the MCA occlusions. We also have basilar occlusions. Typically, the trials don't even study those. We really just study usually the anterior circulation, which is not to say that we don't do it in the posterior circulation. We just don't study it as well. But mortality anyway is what I wanted to show you is actually pretty high. So you're looking at, like in these down here, 57%, oops, this one, 43%, 34%. Some of them had lower mortality, 16 and 28. And then recanalization rate, typically 57, 54, 66, here's an 81%. And then percent intracerebral hemorrhage is obviously much higher than it is with IV tPA. You're typically around 10%. In 2012, there were several big trials that came out, and I'm not going to go over them in detail, but I did want to say that the mortality was a bit lower in these, 17 and 21%. The recanalization rate was still similar, though, at 60%. These were using new devices, the Solitaire and the Stentrievers, and then Diffuse was using advanced imaging to choose who went to therapy. So I'm going to go over the two trials that came out last year. My fellow likes to call it the Honolulu shock because they were both presented in Honolulu, and it was very distressing to our community. So IMS-3 has been a trial that has been going on basically forever, as far as most of us feel, 2006 to 2012. It's a 2-to-1 randomized trial, and it used IV tPA with catheter-based therapy versus just IV tPA alone. And it was planned for 900 patients, a multi-center trial. The tPA had to be begun within 3 hours of both groups, and then they were randomized at 40 minutes to either going to the cath lab or not. And what's really important to understand is that it didn't matter what type of stroke you had, you were randomized to the cath lab or not. So you could have a lacunar stroke and go to the cath lab, or you could have a large intracarotid artery stroke and still go to the cath lab. Intra-arterial therapy had to be begun within 5 hours and completed within 7, and the primary endpoint was, as usual, modified Rankin score. So these are the results. The study was stopped for futility in 2012 after about 2/3 of the patients were enrolled. And now you remember, see, I told you you were going to see these grotto bars a lot, so it's worth it to learn them here. This is overall, this is an NIH stroke scale of 8 to 19, so moderate stroke, and then this is the severe stroke group. And the tPA group by itself is in this bottom one, and the endovascular therapy is in the top one. And I didn't put p-values, but none of them were significant. There was no difference between any of these groups. So the group that went to the cath lab didn't do any better than the group that just got tPA. And it's very interesting because, you know, I've been taking calls from the state and states around us for a long time now about stroke, and ER docs will say, well, don't you just think he needs a cath in his brain? I'm like, well, it's really not the same as the heart. Maybe he needs an IV in his arm, you know? So we've been having this discussion for a long time. These results have been very interesting. So these are the actual percentages. Favorable outcome of an MRS less than 2, so that's either no symptoms or very mild symptoms. We're basically 40% in both groups. Mortality was the same in both groups. Symptomatic ICH was the same in both groups, and the groups are well matched. One thing to notice, though, is that their time to IV was 2 hours. So that's not door to IV, that's symptom onset to IV. And then IV to IR start was 127 minutes, and we're going to focus on that for a few slides. So these are some limitations. This is the biggest one is the one I put first, going on the theory that you might fall asleep at any time. So IMS-3 does not reflect what we currently do for intra-arterial therapy. So we don't take people with a lacunar stroke, which if you don't know the word lacune, it means small artery, so like just the basal ganglia or just the thalamus. We would never take someone like that to the cath lab because there's no large artery occlusion. There's only a tiny artery that you can't actually reach with a catheter. And in this study, they took everybody, whether they had a large artery occlusion or not. And in fact, in over half of the enrolled patients, there was no large artery occlusion. Second, they used devices that were not preferentially, but just because of the time course of the trial, were in the early years of IR therapy. And those tended to be those ones that I told you I could go eat dinner and come back, and they're still at it and trying different devices. They just didn't work as well. This sort of gets into the, well, if we just have a better device, then I'm sure we can make a difference. There is some of that, but I think some of this is real, that the longer you wait to open up an artery, the worse patients are going to do. And that gets to me the next part. So the mean time from onset to start of intra-arterial therapy was 249 minutes. That is a really long time. Now, around here, if patients are coming from far away, that's frankly what sometimes we do as well, but it's not the goal, and I think it's one of the reasons that patients didn't do well. And then this one, mean time from IV tPA to puncture was 2 hours. So that's a long time to move from the giving tPA to the cath lab. And second to last, the recanalization rate was quite low. It was only 40%. You remember me showing you in those newer trials, we're up at like 80%. So that may have played a role. And then full dose IV tPA was not actually given in the endovascular arm early on because they were worried it wasn't safe. So they would stop the infusion at 40 minutes and then hold the remainder, and it was just a guess. But after several studies had come out saying that was actually safe to give full-dose IV tPA, they switched that, and that didn't happen until later. So there's several post-hoc analyses, as these things go, trying to see if there was any group in which IR therapy benefited, because nobody's quite ready to give up this investment of technology and brain power and hope, I guess. And so they're trying to find out, are there patients that would still benefit from this? Of those patients who were reperfused, so just those who got their arteries back opened, increased time to reperfusion was associated with a decreased likelihood of a good clinical outcome. So it's exactly what I've been saying all along. The longer they waited, the worse they did. And that was significant whether it was adjusted or unadjusted. Similarly, and this is kind of an interesting subject that if you're a real nerd, you really get into. So collaterals are this concept of having additional arteries that are going to go around your occlusion. It's just like when the freeway is blocked and everybody gets off the freeway and gets back on again at a new exit or a new entrance. In patients who have good collaterals, we've always known that they do very well. There are patients that can have a big arterial occlusion and they walk out of the hospital despite me not treating them because I couldn't get to them in time. And it's always been a question, how can we make everybody behave this way? So they did a post-hoc analysis of patients in whom they could see their collaterals, and if they had a good collateral of grade, it was associated with both recanalization, so opening up the proximal artery, and downstream perfusion, so being able to perfuse that distal brain. A good collateral grade was a very significant predictor of a good 90-day clinical outcome. The end statement in the paper was, of course, the relationship between collateral flow and outcome may depend on the degree of reperfusion. So these things are very related, but there's no question that if you are lucky enough to be born with good collaterals, you're probably going to do better. Whether that means we should go in with the catheter or not is not clear, but there were some patients who did okay with this. And then this one was published by Pooja Khatri at University of Cincinnati, who worked on IMS-3. So this is a post-hoc analysis of looking at all of the delays. And I just thought it was kind of interesting to run through it and see what were their delays in this trial. A couple things they found. So IV tPA to groin puncture, 84, if they had less, if that time was shorter, they did better. If the CT to groin puncture time was shorter, they did better, and it was shorter during working hours than non-working hours, which isn't a surprise to any of us who do this. The times decreased over the study period. So I think as physicians became aware of how important time is, that got better throughout the subsequent years. There were shorter times if the patient got a CTA, which is interesting to me because we routinely get a CTA and I always worry that maybe we're doing the wrong thing. But in this study, at least, patients who got a CTA actually did better, and I think it's because we could hand that information to the interventionalist and say, okay, here's where the problem is in the artery, here's what you need to open up. Transferred patients had longer times, that's no surprise. And then one thing that actually made me kind of happy was age, sex, stroke scale, and intubation didn't affect their times. Typically, women have longer times, older people have longer times, so it was nice to see that that did not happen in this study. All right, we're sort of on the home stretch here. So MR Rescue came out at the same meeting in Hawaii, in Honolulu, so it's our second Honolulu shockwave or whatever. This was a trial that ran from 2004 to 2011, and they randomized patients to thrombectomy versus standard of care, which included IV if they were eligible for it. And the big deal with this was that they used advanced imaging, MR imaging and CT imaging, to look at perfusion to see if patients would benefit from it. So they had what we call a favorable perfusion pattern, and I'll show you one of those, and an unfavorable perfusion pattern. And they tried to see who was going to benefit, if you would benefit more if you had a favorable pattern. So I pulled some random slides, not from my patients, but from the literature, just to show you. So some of you may not be familiar with this. So this is an 87-year-old lady. She had acute dysarthria, left facial droop, left side weakness, so presumably a right MCA stroke. Her head CT actually looks okay. Probably if I could window it, I might find something like a little duskiness of the gray-white junction, but basically it looks all right. This is called a cerebral blood flow. This is blood volume, and this is mean transit time. And I'm pretty sure you can see that the mean transit time and the cerebral blood volume are both pretty asymmetric. You've got a big color mismatch side to side. And this means that your flow is down and your transit time is up. I don't think this one projects as well, but the volume over here is down as well. And this lady has what we call a matched perfusion deficit. Volume is typically, the CBV or volume, is typically felt to mean that you have a core stroke. That is where your tissue is dead. the area around it, all of this, is felt to be perfusion abnormalities or the penumbra. So I sometimes want to give my residents little buttons to say, like, save the penumbra, right? Like, our whole goal in stroke care is to keep, you know, the tissue that's dead, it's dead. I can't help it. But the tissue that's not dead yet, I'd really like to keep from becoming dead. But in this lady, you would say there's not much hope. Even though her head CT looks okay, her imaging looks pretty bad. And that's in contrast to this guy, a 64-year-old man with headache and acute aphasia. In this patient, his cerebral blood flow here and here, and the radiologist put little arrows there, are down, but the volume is okay. And what that is saying is that there's no actual core of stroke yet. The tissue is stunned and it's not working, but it's not dead. This is a pretty small stroke to be going after with a catheter, but that's the idea between a favorable penumbra and an unfavorable penumbral pattern. So in MR rescue, patients were either assigned to undergo embolectomy, meaning catheter, or standard of care, which could include IV therapy, and then they just did imaging and collected it to see who had favorable penumbra and who did not. These are what I was telling you about, the famous grotto bars again, so you have to bear with me for a minute. This is the group that had favorable imaging, and then non-favorable imaging and non-favorable imaging. And one thing I want to point out right off the bat is whether they got embolectomy or not, catheter or not, all of these are shifted compared to these in a more favorable position. In other words, if you have favorable imaging from the get-go, you're more likely to have a better outcome in the end, no matter what I do to you. So this group, embolectomy in the non-penumbral pattern, had no benefit whatsoever. So overall, meaning the IR group versus standard of care had no difference in their modified Rankine scores with a P of like 0.99, so truly no difference. In the group that had a favorable penumbral pattern, IR versus standard of care still wasn't significant, and in the non-penumbral pattern, it wasn't significant when you're comparing IR versus standard of care. Again, a negative trial saying don't use penumbral imaging to choose whether you're going to IR or not, okay? So let's go over the inevitable problems. So is advanced imaging dead? So this is still what a lot of us do. We get this advanced imaging and we say we're going to use this advanced imaging to now decide whether you get a catheter or not. So I should have like a clock ticking up here, but mean time to IR start in this study was 370 minutes. That's 6 hours. That's an insane amount of time, okay? And that is probably one of the hugest issues. Again, recanalization rate was low because they used old devices at only 27%. And then a big issue for me, and this is, I don't know how many of you guys remember the days when we had PTs and no INRs and what a disaster it was because you couldn't compare INRs across patients or across centers. Well, that's where we're at right now with advanced imaging in neurology. So a CT perfusion and MR perfusion are not the same. They don't give you the same answer. And one done at Ogden versus Utah versus wherever, Boston, they won't give you the same answer either. So the standardization of what a penumbral pattern looks like isn't there. And so you can have somebody that on one image looks like they have a penumbral pattern, on another they don't. And so maybe we weren't actually measuring things correctly. One of the quotes they had was, it is possible that patients with a favorable penumbral pattern, particularly in the late time windows, may have good functional outcome regardless of which treatment they undergo. And that's really reflecting this thing that I was showing you before. The two top bars really looked better than the two bottom bars, no matter what we did to them or what the study group did to them. But in early time windows, maybe there is more benefit if you have a good penumbral pattern. And in late time windows, maybe the ones who did well were those that had collaterals, like I was talking about before. Or maybe it doesn't matter because the tissue's already dead, so you don't have much benefit. So what's the frontier for catheter-based therapies? Kind of what I've been alluding to, better patient selection using advanced imaging, either collaterals or perfusion. We actually use a lot of just plain head CTs now. I didn't go over the aspect score, but it's a way to just look at a regular old head CT. This is what we do with telestroke patients, and you actually can get a pretty good idea just on a head CT of whether somebody, how big their stroke is and whether they're safe to go to IR therapy or not. Faster treatment. I always like calling them fancy catheters, you know, better technology, better living through better technology. And then the question of extending the time windows, probably not. We're probably not going to try to treat people further out because the data just keeps coming back negative, except perhaps in wake-up strokes. So this is my picture for the state of catheter-based therapies right now. This is the Gooseneck State Park, the San Juan River. It's basically a big twisty road, and I have no idea where it's going to end up. And so we don't know what we're doing right now, and I think it's a big, big moving target. And I will say, after those two trials came out, there were many centers who stopped doing catheter-based therapy. We are not one of those centers at the U, but we are we're much more cautious than we used to be about who we take to the cath lab. All right, so bottom line, catheter-based therapies, I think I already said this, select patients may benefit. You need an experienced operator. I wouldn't have a body IR guy doing it if I could help it. And this is a big deal. The possibility of IR therapy should never preclude IV therapy. And I've seen people do this. When there is an FDA-approved treatment, that should be the go-to and what people are giving, and never saying, well, I'll just avoid that and take you to the cath lab instead. I think that is very clearly shown to not be a good idea. And then obviously it must be done quickly. So stop wasting time. All right, so I wasn't sure how quickly I would finish. I can take questions. I have three slides on just like my overall summary of inpatient care, but I did it really fast because I knew I wouldn't have time for it. Or I can just take questions, whatever you guys want. Yes, sir.
How about PFOs?
PFOs, all right. Well, that might be on the next slide, so. Okay, I'll do this then. All right, so one thing that is a big deal to me is when someone is hospitalized with stroke, after you've done their TPA or their catheter or whatever, is understanding why they had their stroke so you can prevent the next one. The list I have up here is what most people would consider a pretty standard workup, brain MRI, extra and intracranial vessel imaging, structural heart imaging, and I really don't want to get into TTE versus TEE, but they're both options. Long-term rhythm monitoring, anyone at risk for AFib, which is all diabetics and most people over 60, lipids, A1C, blood pressure. And then in the young, particularly hypercoagulable state, HIV and drug screening. And the reason is because you have to institute secondary prevention. And so it's really important that they have early antiplatelets, early statins. Blood pressure control should come later. You don't want to do that too fast. Very few people anymore are given Coumadin for stroke prevention. It's pretty much the artificial valves and the atrial fibrillation and cerebral venous thrombosis. There's almost an antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. I think that's it. You can count on one hand how many people have Coumadin indications anymore. And PFO closure. So if you come to the stroke symposium on Saturday, Dr. DeWitt is giving an entire talk on PFO closure. But I can be the spoiler if you want and tell you that all the trials have been negative so far. And those came out in the last couple of years. We are participating in a trial right now that is supposedly better with a better device and better patient selection, but we will not close patients, at least in neurology, without putting them in a trial. And there are insurance who will deny it, which is probably a good thing. I think in Utah, over the past decade or two, there's been a lot of closing going on that's probably inappropriate. There are a few patients who you say, you know, they're pregnant, they have a big DVT, and they have a PFO, but, you know, so there are a couple of patients that you might say need it, or they may need it anatomically because they have an ASD as well, but that's a different situation. Symptomatic carotid stenosis obviously needs to be treated. Sampras was a big trial that came out a couple years ago showing that intracranial stenting is out. There's no role for it, and that actually really good exercise and lipid lowering and blood pressure lowering is way better than a stent in your brain. This is my last slide. Treatment of a stroke, prevention of complications, so DVT prophylaxis, swallow evaluation, prevent pneumonias, neuro ICU management, and then really important is the early therapies and rehab, and then social work, family support, dealing with their mood and cognition. All of those could take up hours of talk, but these are things that I didn't want you to think I didn't care about just because I spent hours talking about IVTPA. All right, so next questions. Yes, sir.
What's the rule of aspirin?
So aspirin, acutely or chronically? Acutely, we like it within 24 hours or, you know, basically as soon as a head CT is done and it's negative. If you've gotten TPA, the guidelines say not to give it for 24 hours, although many people are on it already. Frankly, they typically do just fine. But aspirin is a very good preventative for stroke. I believe, based on several studies, that it's equivalent to clopidogrel, so I use it as my primary prevention measure, typically just 81 milligrams a day. Some pharmacists have told me that they think patients who have obesity and or diabetes have rapid platelet turnover, so sometimes they'll recommend a higher dose, like 325. But no, it's great. It still only has 23% risk reduction, though, so it's not enough, right? It's a good antiplatelet, but there's a lot of other reasons people have strokes, including blood pressure and diabetes and hypercholesterolemia, and so all those have to be addressed, too. I think we get a little hung up on antiplatelets sometimes as if it's the main thing. Like somebody fails because they have a stroke on aspirin, so somebody puts them on Coumadin, and that's not logical. So, yes, sir. Intra, yeah, I tried to, but I probably skipped around between IR and IA. So IA is intra-arterial therapy, and IR is interventional radiology. Sorry, I knew I was going to do that to you. Yes, Dr. Roman?
A while ago, there was data on different styles of meditation reducing intimal thickness. Where does that stand for stroke?
I don't know. I think there's a lot right now about stress reduction and meditation, things of that nature that help reduce our general inflammatory state. There's a lot going on, but I'm not entirely up on that literature. And some trials have clearly been negative as well.
With statins, is it important to treat to a certain level of cholesterol, LDL, or just have them on an adequate dose of statin?
Right. So the two studies that studied stroke specifically, one used simvastatin 40 milligrams and one used atorvastatin 80 milligrams. So those are the two I tend to go to, depending on how high their LDL is. But neither of them used an LDL goal for treatment. So I tend to just put them on it. I've been to some rather convincing lectures on patients or on physicians who, rather than treating to an LDL, treat to like intimal thickness, or if you have intracranial stenosis, they actually reimage. And if the stenosis is getting tighter, they up their statin therapy and they up their exercise and other things like that. So rather than using a number, actually using their physiology. I wouldn't say that that's like written into the guidelines at this point, but that's something that I sometimes consider when I'm dealing with patients with true stenoses. Yes. Right, so he asked, why do statins increase the risk of hemorrhagic stroke? So in general, low LDL is associated with a risk of intracerebral hemorrhage, treated or untreated, and we don't know. So clearly, we think of statins as a vascular stabilizing agent, but there is a negative relationship with hemorrhage. And so if someone has a primary intracerebral hemorrhage, right, statin would not be considered an appropriate therapy for that. On the other hand, if they also happen to have, you know, terrible heart disease, you might choose a low-dose statin and kind of try to go through the middle on that, depending on which problem is worse. The data is clear that when you, like, so the SPARKLE trial, for example, took all stroke and put them all on statins. Now, just the way stroke is, only 15% is intracerebral hemorrhage, so the vast majority is going to be ischemic. It was a very positive trial. But in those that came in with primary intracerebral hemorrhage, they had more secondary intracerebral hemorrhage on the statin. So, yeah, it's not something that we recommend, but no, I don't understand the pathophysiology of it. You guys are quiet over here on this side. I keep forgetting to look at you, too, so I'm sorry about that. Oh, yes, sir. Yeah, so generally we would consider taking somebody to intra-arterial therapy, or IR, as I messed up earlier, for proximal lesions only, so basilar or carotid or proximal MCA. I have done distal MCA in patients who have just had a big surgery and couldn't get IV therapy. It didn't go very well, though. So I think most of us try to do the proximals only, and that's clearly what all the studies have been in. They've never been in the distals. So typically, we only do distal stuff when we're feeling pretty pushed. And I wouldn't consider it standard of care by any stretch. Yes, sir?
On patients who are at risk of bleeding, this sounds like something way out of the path. What about lesions? Actually, not lesions, but what about reducing your hematocrit? Doesn't that affect the rheology? No study to have it.
I have no idea. Sorry, I laughed too hard in the microphone. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know any data on that, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means I don't know. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think that's becoming more and more the common way of thinking about it, is to see if they're on it or not. There's one, please. Go ahead.
Question on imaging tests. Is the carotid ultrasound enough, or are you recommending MR angiogram of neck and intracranial vessels?
Right, so I like to see the intracranial vessels, most particularly in somebody that I think has intracranial stenosis, because that's the only way I can identify it. So a carotid ultrasound only goes, obviously, from here to here. So you'll miss a fair amount of pathophysiology. So from the perspective of stroke subtypes, which I think is actually a really interesting subject, cardioembolic stroke is about a quarter of strokes, large artery athero is another quarter, and that's split evenly between the neck and the head. And so you may think somebody has a cryptogenic stroke, but actually they have a tight MCA. And that's, again, gets at like the PFO stuff. So maybe they have a PFO, but also a tight MCA, and their stroke's in that bed. Probably the problem is the MCA, not the PFO. So I like to get full vessel imaging. I don't actually care if it's a CTA or an MRA. Well, I have a personal preference, but it's not borne out by the literature. So I think whichever one is fine. But in an elderly patient where you know you're never going to do a carotid artery, you know, you're not going to operate on that artery, you may decide that an ultrasound is a nice non-invasive way to go. So we do it, you know, we'll do it sometimes. Thank you very much, you guys. Great questions.
All right. What a great day. And thank you so much, Dr. House and Dr. Majerzik, for providing us with all that very usable information. Our last lecture of the day is Dr. Chris Hammond. He's going to be speaking on Parkinson's disease and other tremors. His lecture was generously sponsored by the Ogden Clinic, so we just wanted to thank them for that. Dr. Hammond is a graduate of BYU and received his medical degree at the Western University in California. He completed a neurology residency at Northwestern University in Chicago. He has practiced with the Ogden Clinic for more than 7 years and has a clinical interest in multiple sclerosis and sleep disorders. He is on staff at McKady Hospital and serves as the stroke director at Ogden Regional Medical Center. He, his wife, and two kids can frequently be seen jogging, enjoying the trails all around Ogden. So let's go ahead and welcome our last lecture of the day, Dr. Hammond.